This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Geht es Ihnen nicht auch auf die Nerven, wenn ein Unternehmen mit all seinen Auszeichnungen prahlt? Uns auch. Fühlt sich so aufgesetzt an, oder? Mit uns von Kapital.com können Sie sich also wieder Ihrem Podcast widmen. Übrigens haben wir bei den 2024 Online Money Awards die Auszeichnung Best Overall Trading Plattform erhalten. Oh, ups. Kapital.com. Viel besser in Sachen Trading als in Sachen Werbung. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld. Der Handel an den Finanzmärkten kann eine einsame Angelegenheit sein. Wenn Sie also wissen möchten, wie man den Dunkelmodus auf Ihrer Plattform aktiviert oder wie Sie auf Ihr Konto einzahlen können, dann ist es gut, wenn Sie mit einem echten Menschen sprechen. Bei Kapital.com sprechen unsere Teams Deutsch, Französisch, Italienisch, Spanisch und viele andere Sprachen. Setzen Sie sich mit uns in Verbindung und wir helfen Ihnen gerne bei der Beantwortung Ihrer Fragen zum Thema Trading. Kapital.com. Entdecken Sie einen Broker, der Ihre Sprache spricht. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 21st of February. Hamas is scrabbling to contain the damage caused by Israel's discovery that the supposed body of hostage Shiri Bebas was in fact that of a Gazan woman, and that according to Israel, her children, whose bodies were repatriated at the same time, had been murdered. I've been talking to Jonathan Dekel-Hen, whose son was released last weekend, and to a Jerusalem-based Palestinian activist who believes his side must make the first move if relations are to be improved. The distinguished writer, who appears to be the victim of the worsening relations between Algeria and its former coloniser France, Elon Musk wields a chainsaw as he celebrates his role in cutting bureaucracy down to size. We'll hear why some congressional Republicans are feeling queasy. With Germany's most consequential election for years taking place this weekend, Jamie Kumarasamy is in Berlin, and why Scotch whisky makers think recognising English single malt could dilute the brand. Well, ceasefire is due to begin at the end of next week, but the first stage isn't over, and its handling is doing little to create the trust needed to get from temporary ceasefire to durable peace. First came the revelation that the coffin said to contain the body of Shiri Bebas actually held the remains of a Gazan woman. Then this, about the fate of her two young sons, whose bodies were repatriated at the same time, was disclosed by Israeli Defence Forces spokesperson Daniel Hagari.
Contrary to Hamas's lies, Ariel and Kfir were not killed in an airstrike. Ariel and Kfir Bebas were murdered by terrorists in cold blood. The terrorists did not shoot the two young boys. They killed them with their bare hands.
Mr. Hagari accused Hamas of attempting to conceal how the boys had died, saying the Israeli statement was based on forensics and intelligence. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu added his voice.
Who kidnaps a little boy and a baby and murders them? Monsters, that's who. All of Israel is united in grief. And as the Prime Minister of Israel, I vow that I will not rest until the savages who executed our hostages are brought to justice. They do not deserve to walk this earth. Nothing will stop me. Nothing.
Well, tonight, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy described as sick and abhorrent both the killing of the children and the failure to repatriate their mother's body. The Israeli military says its investigation reports that Hamas has handed over a body it says is that of Shiri Bebas to the Red Cross. And if there's further news on this before the end of the programme, we'll bring it to you. Jonathan Dekel-Hen knew the Bebas family well. His family and theirs were part of the same kibbutzim, one of the places attacked by Hamas on October the 7th, 2023. Last weekend, Jonathan's son Saji was freed. When we spoke, I asked him first how Saji was doing.
For us as a family, it's been a kind of rebirth of my beloved son. He emerged really from the valley of death. We weren't sure that he was still alive. We had no idea what his physical condition might be. And so we have been overjoyed, overcome with the beauty of having him back, of him reuniting with his three little girls and with his wife, who's been the love of his life since he was 16 and she was 14. On the other hand, it's been excruciating because from our same small community, we had four murdered members of our kibbutz return to Israel on Thursday. It turned out this morning that the mother of the two boys who were returned is actually not her body. It's the body of some anonymous person. So that has caused all of us a great deal of heartache. So we're doing our best to balance between the beauty of having our son home with the ongoing crisis with the hostages. There are still 70 who must still come home.
Did you know Shiri Bibas?
Yeah, I've known her family for the last 45 years. Shiri, I helped grow her like other kids on the kibbutz. She's a very good friend of my younger daughter. The children, Ariel and Kfir, Ariel was the best friend of one of my grandkids on the kibbutz, and they used to roll into my house once or twice a week for ice cream and popsicles, just the most beautiful little boy. It is beyond human understanding how anyone could find justification in murdering this mother and her two little boys.
Leaving aside the question of the body, which is obviously profoundly distressing for the family, on top of the distress of getting back bodies, not people, still alive. According to the Israeli government, the boys had been killed by someone's bare hands. That must be very painful to hear, particularly as you are a grandfather as well. And also, as you say, you knew those boys.
Yes, it is. It's beyond words how disturbing it is to think that there are human beings out there, if we can call them that, that found justification for doing such a thing.
Having seen the condition in which hostages appeared when they'd been released the previous weekend, one could understand if you were a bit nervous about seeing your son again for the first time and what condition he might be in. What was it about seeing him that made you realise that this really was your son back, and that however much he'd been changed by his terrible experience, the boy, the man you loved, was still there?
Like the rest of the world, I saw just macabre scene of the exchange between Hamas and the Red Cross, and it was difficult to know. We saw that physically he was in distress, and about an hour later, he crossed the border with the other released hostages, and shortly after that, we were able to meet him for the first time. Just looking at him, you know, within seconds, I realized my boy was back. As Sagi, since he was very little, he has always spoken with his eyes. His eyes tell you his entire life story. And from the second I was able to look him in the eyes, I knew that whatever had happened to him was going to be fixable, but that was my son. There was not a question in my mind.
This is the really hard question, and there's probably not even one answer to it, but how do you see your way through this? How did you, as an Israeli citizen, as a father who has gone through so much and watched your family go through so much, how do you look to a future for your country, for Israelis and for Palestinians?
Well, you're right. That is the most difficult question. The kibbutzim, these cooperative farms along the border with Gaza, have always been the spearhead of the Israeli peace movement. And these same places were the site of massacres on October 7th. And it's not just the terrorists who came. In our kibbutz alone, there were a couple hundred assault terrorists who simply came to kill and to kidnap. But alongside of the terrorists, there were many hundreds more of looters, civilians, and most of them unarmed, from little kids to grannies, who came to loot all of our property as the massacre was going on and burn our homes to the ground. So I don't have answers. But it's been a reckoning for me, having been a peace activist myself for most of my adult life. Is there really a possibility of coexistence with the people of Gaza? No matter how we got to October 7th, I want to believe that a post-Hamas Gaza, whatever that looks like, there has to be room for hope there, because Hamas will have won. You know, they had grand designs of the destruction of Israel and a kind of holy war. That didn't happen. And so in that sense, there was a failure by Hamas, this massacre on October 7th. But on the other hand, if what remains in Israel and in Gaza is just blind hatred for each other, then that is a kind of victory for the spirit of Hamas. But I pray that that is not the result. I want a better future for my grandkids in Israel. And I believe that most Palestinians want a different and better future for their kids.
That's Jonathan Dachachen, whose son Sagi was freed. He was speaking before tonight's news of the handover of body Hamas claims is Shiri Bibas. If even Israelis who had long been part of the peace movement are struggling to see the path to a permanent peace with Palestinians, is it surprising that the prospects look bleak? Sama Sinjawali is a Palestinian who grew up in a mixed community in East Jerusalem. He attended a Christian-run school. In the late 1980s, in the first Palestinian intifada or uprising, he was a stone-throwing teenager. 5 years in an Israeli jail didn't harden his views, though it helped to change them. He believes change is needed now if there's to be any hope, and explained to me why he thinks it must come first from the Palestinian side. First, though, I asked him what he did once he was released from prison.
When I went out, I was elected to be the international secretary for Fatah Youth, and this brought me to start talking to young political leaders in my age from the other side. And I am now engaged into dialogue with people from left, center, and right. So I talk to Israel from wall to wall. And I can claim that I know you better than you know yourselves, because I talk to all of you, you don't talk to each other. And this is something very important, Shwan. When you start seeing the conflict in the eyes of the other side, you will be able to realize what are the better ways. I believe that the common enemy for Israelis and Palestinians is their ignorance of each other. And for me as a Palestinian, I can say I've learned some very important things about the Israelis. First of all, the need for security is real, that the Palestinians are a security threat. So for us as the Palestinian, we need to realize that I don't need to defeat the Israelis. I need to defeat the fear inside the Israelis.
Isn't the consequence of what happened on October the 7th, though, that fear has been given a real concrete identity, and that therefore, if nothing else, October the 7th has set back that process of which you had been a part for maybe a generation?
If we start realizing that the current strategy that we have been adapting for the last 60, 70 years, which is basically using violence on the ground, this strategy does not work. We need to persuade the Israelis. We need to touch their hearts and minds. And maybe they will start understanding that also they need to adapt to a strategy that puts the human dignity and freedom of the Palestinian on its basis, not out of charity, but also out of Israeli national interest.
In other words, enlightened self-interest. But isn't one of the consequences of what has happened over the last 18 months or so that it's that in Israeli political debate, the loudest voices are those who argue from a more ideological perspective rather than necessarily purely a security one?
Well, Shwan, I think it's time for a change. And I think we, the Palestinians, need to start this change, because we are under a sense of urgency. The Israelis, despite the price they pay for this conflict, and they pay price, they have pain, but still they have a very nice country, strong in economies. Their kids live a very nice life. They can wait another 75 years. We cannot wait another 75 hours with 2.3 million people under plastic tents in Gaza.
How badly do the Palestinians and the Israelis, in your view, need a change of leadership?
It's the only thing that is needed. You know, most of the confusion inside the minds of the Israelis and Palestinians are because of these two leaders. Israelis and Palestinians are capable to live to each other and coexist. If you go today to the Hebrew University, 30% of the student is Palestinians. The fact that they accept to come to the same classrooms with the same professor, and sometimes this professor gives them a group work where two Palestinians and two Israelis start working together. By nature, we are capable to coexist. If new leaders come, the dynamics will change very quickly.
That's the Palestinian activist Sama Sinjawali, part of the Palestinian Voices series here on The World Tonight. Coming up later in the programme. Oh, yes, that's starting to clear the tubes. I share a dram with a lover of fine malt, discovering why for Scotch whisky makers, the barley doesn't have to be local, but the distilling does, and why the English want to do it differently.
This is the chainsaw for bureaucracy.
Der Handel an den Finanzmärkten kann eine einsame Angelegenheit sein. Wenn Sie also wissen möchten, wie man den Dunkelmodus auf Ihrer Plattform aktiviert oder wie Sie auf Ihr Konto einzahlen können, dann ist es gut, wenn Sie mit einem echten Menschen sprechen. Bei Capital.com sprechen unsere Teams Deutsch, Französisch, Italienisch, Spanisch und viele andere Sprachen. Setzen Sie sich mit uns in Verbindung und wir helfen Ihnen gerne bei der Beantwortung Ihrer Fragen zum Thema Trading. Capital.com. Entdecken Sie einen Broker, der Ihre Sprache spricht. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Welcome to the Criminalia podcast.
Together, we invite you into the dark and winding corridors of historical true crime.
Each season, we explore a new theme, from poisoners to art thieves.
We uncover the secrets of history's most interesting figures.
And tune in at the end of each episode as we indulge in cocktails and mocktails inspired by each story.
Listen to Criminalia on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Criminalia.
Chainsaw!
Elon Musk wielding a chainsaw yesterday at CPAC, a conference of American conservatives. He was presented with it by President Milei of Argentina, who shares the same enthusiasm for cutting government down to size. Overnight, a judge ruled that the mass firing of employees of the federal government can proceed. Some Republicans, though, are starting to feel a bit queasy. In the last hour, Donald Trump was asked by a reporter in the White House about that unease among Republicans and among people who voted Republican.
I have today the highest poll numbers I've ever had. I have today the highest poll numbers of any Republican president ever. We haven't even checked the Democrats, but that's what I was just told. And they like the job that we're doing. They like the job that Elon's doing. He's doing something that a lot of people wouldn't have the courage to do. We want to streamline our country. We want to streamline, because you know why? Because we want our country to survive and thrive.
Live to Washington, D.C., where Politico's congressional reporter Meredith Lee Hill covers the work of the Republican Party leadership on Capitol Hill. Meredith, welcome to The World Tonight. You heard what the president had to say publicly. Congress seems to be in lockstep with the White House. What are Republicans who talk to you, though, saying privately?
We're hearing a lot from Republicans, obviously publicly, who are very supportive of the president and his agenda, and generally agree with the principle of reining in and cutting back the size of the federal government. Though we are hearing lots of consternation behind the scenes from Republicans on Capitol Hill, who have over this past weekend spent hours scrambling, trying to find any White House official who would pick up a phone to try to make their case to argue to scale back some of these mass firings, in particular worried about public health and safety facing rules, positions like microbiologists and other researchers working in the United States to stop the spread of the bird flu pandemic that's hurting both dairy farms and poultry farms here. So there's been a lot of frenetic energy over the past few days trying to essentially get in touch with any White House official possible and make the case to slow down and take a bit more care in some of these decisions.
Yeah, I mean, the reports of the Food and Drug Administration is believed, this is according to the New York Times, have lost about 700 of its 18,000 employees. It doesn't sound like a lot as a proportion, but presumably it depends which jobs are being cut.
Right. There are, I mean, the federal workforce in the United States is a huge thing. And there's obviously a lot of thinking in the White House that a lot of these roles are just, you know, left-leaning people in Washington, D.C. But really, these jobs are across the whole country, as far north, obviously, you know, as Alaska, where Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican herself, has raised public concerns about the level of federal workers in her state that have been recently let go.
And there's one example, I think, isn't there, of a suggestion that it might have affected the safety of the nuclear arsenal.
Right. There were firings across a key team who are charged with, you know, keeping safe the United States nuclear weapons and our security, and they were let go as part of these mass firings. It appears because the DOGE team working through this didn't understand the operations that these folks were doing. And once it came to light that these were people in charge of nuclear safety, they were White House officials basically scrambled to try to rehire these people.
Good job. There's some rethinking going on. Meredith Lee Hill of Politico, thank you so much for joining us on The World Tonight. Should what defines a single malt whisky change? It's a question causing tension between the long-established Scottish industry and its newer challenger down south. DEFRA, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs of the UK government, is considering an application for what's called a geographical indication, a legal standard, if you like, from the English Whisky Guild. But Graham Littlejohn of the Scotch Whisky Association objects, saying it would dilute what single malt means.
The single malt category has been for decades defined by the Scotch whisky industry, and it's based on a very simple but quality standard, and it essentially means that all new make spirit should be produced at one site. That is what single means, and what the English proposal would do is to strip that away.
Well, that was Graham Littlejohn of the Scotch Whisky Association. There's only one way, really, to find out exactly what's happening behind the scenes on this story, and that's to go to a whisky retailer and a whisky expert.
Yeah, so my name's Billy Abbott. I'm the ambassador here at the Whisky Exchange.
Right, educate me. What are the processes that are involved in creating a whisky?
Basically, what you need to do is you need to make a beer. That involves taking some barley or other grain, grinding it up, mixing it with hot water, extracting all the starches and sugars. Then you add some yeast, which ferments that into this beer. Then the next stage for whisky making specifically is you need to distill that. And that's when you turn it into a high-strength spirit. It's a bit like a bit of a rubbish vodka, but it doesn't taste very good then. But the whole point is you put it into a wooden cask, you know, and leave it to mature. And over the years, it becomes this beautiful spirit that we know as whisky.
Right, let's go and have a wander over, shall we? Because you've got a couple of examples that might help you illustrate this story.
The English Whisky Guild, who are a trade body put together by distillers of whisky in England, have put together a proposal for a geographic indication. So this is a document which describes how a product will be made in a certain geography to express that place. And so the process is they propose this GI and then they put it out for comment and people object to pieces of it. There's discussions, they rewrite it, and this goes on until such time as we have this regulation. And the Scotch Whisky Association, they've put in an objection about one very small technical... Well, they've said they're going to put an objection. They haven't actually maybe done it yet, but they've told everybody what they want to do. An objection to one very small technical detail of what you could call a single malt whisky.
Right.
And how it differs between the countries.
You've got two bottles here that might help us illustrate this. These are both single malts. What do we mean by single malt, first of all?
So single malt is two separate pieces. Single and malt. The SWA and the English Whisky Guild pretty much agree on malt. So malt whisky is a whisky made from 100% malted barley. Single means it's made at one distillery.
Right.
And that's the piece where they differ slightly on what they mean by made at one distillery.
So the Scotch Whisky Association says it's in our geographical indication, it's at the heart of what we are, it's that it's all done in a single place. The proposal from the English Whisky Guild doesn't mention a single place. So you could do your mashing, getting that beer you were telling us about in one place, and then you could actually do the distilling somewhere else.
Yes.
Right. Tell us about the two whiskies you've got here. This is the best bit. Oh, that is the sound I wanted to hear.
So the first one we have is a single malt Scotch whisky, which means it's made from barley, which can come from pretty much anywhere, which is then turned into a beer, distilled and matured in Scotland.
Oh, yes. That's starting to clear the tubes. Oh, a slight burn on the lips. That ticks all the boxes required for a Scotch whisky single malt.
Yes, Scotch single malt whisky. This is absolutely solid. The distillery who makes this and the company who own it would never do anything else but.
That's lovely.
And our second whisky is from Yorkshire. So this is produced by the Spirit of Yorkshire.
How big is the English industry getting now? Because presumably it's nothing like on the scale of the Scottish.
Oh, no, I don't know the exact numbers, but I saw a diagram from the Scotch Whisky Association the other day stating it was like 1% of the entirety of the UK market is made in England, as opposed to 99% in Scotland. So this whisky basically trips the rule that the SWA are complaining about.
Because?
So, The company started as the Waltop Brewery, which is up the top of a hill in Yorkshire near the distillery, and they brew their beer for their whiskey there. They then tanker it down to the coast to distill it at their distillery.
Your health, Billy. Indeed. Thank
Cheers.
You. It is different, but it's not so different.
No.
I couldn't even put into words what the difference is, but dare I use a word, it's probably not a very whiskey word, it's more tangy than the first one.
Tangy's a really good word for it. Jeremy, this one specifically, I love this whiskey, and this is a fantastic excuse for me to grab the sample bottle out of our stash. It's very, very fruity.
Let me ask you then finally, how do you think this difference of opinion can best be resolved?
I don't know whether the stipulation of fermenting and mashing in the same distillery will continue. I hope not, because I very much like Filey Bay whiskey, and that would really impact the character of what they do. But this is just a process that happens, and it's actually fairly boring when you look at it. It's just a little bit more interesting and a bit spicier at the moment because we have a load of people getting involved, and because whiskey really does, you know, bring out lots of feelings and
ignites passions.
Whiskey very much ignites passion. It's very evocative, and it's something that people really care about. Cheers.
Billy Abbott, thank you very much. You're listening to The World Tonight. It's now 10:30. The main stories this evening. Hamas has handed over another body to the Red Cross. It says is that of Israeli hostage Shiri Bibas, after admitting the body returned yesterday as hers was not. The man who attacked the writer Sir Salman Rushdie as he was speaking at an event in New York is facing up to 25 years in jail tonight after being found guilty of attempted murder. Hadi Mattar stabbed him repeatedly, blinding him in one eye. Sir Salman had faced multiple death threats since the publication of his novel The Satanic Verses back in the 1980s. A year on from the attack, he spoke with Razi Iqbal here on The World Tonight.
I suppose I feel, first of all, just very lucky. I discover what a lucky person I am. And then there was this huge outpouring of kind of support and affection, you know, and that was incredibly moving to feel, to be on the receiving end of that, you know. And it's a little strange because back in the day, at the moment when these threats first began, back in 1989, frankly, there wasn't so much of an outpouring of affection.
Sir Salman Rushdie talking to The World Tonight. A year after the attack, his attacker has now been convicted and sentencing will take place next month. To Germany now, where perhaps the most consequential federal election since reunification takes place on Sunday. And Jamie Kumarasamy is there for us tonight. Good evening, Jamie. Before we talk about this weekend, there's been a stabbing at the Holocaust Memorial where you are in Berlin.
Yeah, that's right, Sean. About 6 o'clock this evening, this stabbing occurred. It's about 10, 15 minutes away from where we are, right in the centre of Berlin. We've learnt this evening that a 30-year-old Spanish tourist was stabbed, seriously injured, we understand. We don't know the identity of the suspected perpetrator who has been arrested. But of course, the context for this is that during this election campaign, there have been a number of attacks, some stabbings, some using vehicles, which have been linked to asylum seekers, and that's played a role in this campaign.
You've been there for a couple of days now. What are people talking about as they prepare to go to the polls?
Well, they're talking about Donald Trump. You will not be surprised to hear. I think everyone is talking about him around the world. But people here are very concerned what he means, what his policy means for Germany, for Europe in general. It's certainly on the mind of the front runner to become the next German chancellor. That's the 69-year-old Friedrich Merz from the Christian Democrats at the centre-right CDU. He is a golf-playing former businessman, would you believe? And he told one interviewer today that the United States could slide into an authoritarian populist system. Of course, people talk about the economy. This is a country that's gone from powerhouse to rather underpowered. Its export-led business model, vulnerable to what's been a triple whammy, a disappearing cheap Russian energy supply, Chinese competition in the car market, and the threat of those Trump tariffs. But there's also immigration. It's at the top or near the top of voters' concerns in this campaign, especially after those attacks I mentioned. And that explains the consistently high support for the party that's taken the toughest line on border controls. That's the AfD from the populist right. It also explains why Friedrich Merz has tried to occupy their territory, to work with them in parliament even, much to the irritation of the woman that Mr. Merz lost out as party leader back in the day, Angela Merkel. Now, a decade after she opened Germany's borders to more than a million, mainly Syrian refugees, attitudes to migrants have certainly changed here. As I've been finding out in Berlin, beginning with one Syrian who arrived in that 2015 Merkel wave and later cooked for the former chancellor.
Well, this is a rather charming Syrian restaurant in the Schönberg district, and you can probably hear preparations in full swing for tonight's customers who are being treated to lovely starters like tabouleh, fattoush. Now, we're very excited to meet the owner of this place. Her name's Malakay Jasmati. She's one of the Syrians who came to Germany a decade ago, and she's made a real success of things.
As a refugee, I leave my Damascus, and it's not easy to leave your homeland, because homeland, it's like mother. When I come to here, start cooking for my friends. Step by step, I surprised now to cook for Angela Merkel. She asked me about the food. She asked me about the recipe of shawarma, because she fell in love with my shawarma.
How do you think of Germany? You say that your mother is Damascus, but how do you think of Germany?
She's my friend, my close friend. When you will close your eyes and think about your close friend, you will be emotional and happy. That's it's my emotion with Berlin.
Now, what would you say then to people who are looking at what's happening in Germany at the moment and say, look, this party on the far right, the AfD, is doing very well. The CDU is also being more tough on immigration, and we'll look at Germany and wonder if it's still a welcoming country. It's still a good country for people to come to. What would you say?
As a refugee, you need to be hard worker. I have a lot of conversation with AfD people. Start to talk about, did you pay your taxes? I told him, maybe more than you. Did you let your children go to school and learn German? I told him, for sure. They know about Christmas. Listen, I'm Muslim, but my grandmother, she's Christian. And after that, he said, I don't have a problem with the example like you. Uh-huh. What do you mean? Syrian people, they helping you. How many doctors, Syrian doctors we have? Did you imagine if those doctors come back to Syria, what it's happened? Da-da-da-da. Don't judge us. You need us.
Hello, you're live with BBC News. I'm Anna Foster here in the German city of Magdeburg, a city in shock this afternoon after five.
But it's the recent spate of attacks by asylum seekers and immigrants, not the work of Syrian doctors or chefs, that explains why immigration has been at the top of German voters' minds, as well as where the attacks are happening, according to Susan Fratzke from the Migration Policy Institute.
Even if there's a low risk of being the victim of an attack that's committed by a migrant, if you tell someone that, that won't necessarily change their perception of that threat. And that's particularly true for the types of crimes that we've seen recently in Germany, which have been really, you know, highly visible and dramatic crimes, like the attack that we saw on the Christmas market in Magdeburg. And in Germany, I think these types of visible events have been particularly salient for people because of how important public gatherings and these types of festivals are.
We have it's security glass.
Although it's smashed up there.
Here somebody tried to throw the fire inside. There were two people inside and they couldn't come out because somebody locked the door from outside. So people would have died here inside. They also wrote...
In the Neukölln district of Berlin, the local integration officer, Gunnar Balci, shows me the site of a less well-known but potentially deadly attack on a cafe bar that's taken a strong stand against anti-Semitism and homophobia.
Well, Neukölln is one of the poorest and also one of the biggest districts we have in Berlin. And in the last years, we had a lot of people coming here from Syria and Iran, Iraq. We really have a problem by finding apartments, flats for the people who come here in the last years. Sometimes it's not really easy to find a school place. We have a large number of I call them reactionary mosques. And these mosques, they also offer Quran lessons, and they are very successful in spreading their ideology into the minds of kids. And a lot of what kids learn there is really against democratic values.
So when political parties say, look, these new arrivals could be a danger to German society, are they right?
Well, the new arrivals are not the danger for the German society. It is how we handle them. People see what happens in their neighborhoods.
They see what happened here.
They see what happens here, and they realize that there are problems that the democratic parties were not able to talk about because they never wanted to be called racist. But it's not racism to talk about problems and to try to solve them.
That was Integration Officer Gunnar Bauchi. Well, the AfD is certainly doing well. 20% of the vote, a historical high. Is it a ceiling, though? We will find out on Sunday evening when the polls close about 6 p.m. local time. I'll be back on The World Tonight on Monday with all the analysis of the results.
James Kumarasamy there in Berlin. Now, Boualem Sansal is an award-winning novelist, 80 years old and living with cancer. He's also a prisoner. For the last 3 months, the Franco-Algerian writer has been in custody in Algeria. He's being held there for breaching state security, but details haven't been forthcoming. His French lawyer still hasn't been granted a visa to see him. From Paris, Hugh Schofield reports.
With his long grey ponytail, Boualem Sansal was a familiar face in the French media. This was him on a popular chat show a few years ago when he'd released a new novel. He was a kind of go-to guy on Algeria, not least because he was very critical of the government there.
France Inter. L'écrivain franco-algérien Boualem Sansal.
So it was a shock when, in November, it was announced that on a visit to Algiers, Sansal had been arrested at the airport under state security laws.
I am the publisher of the last book of Boualem Sansal.
Paris publisher Jean-François Colosimo knows Boualem Sansal well. He describes him as a humane and gentle person and a genuine free thinker.
Above all, he's a man who trusts in human brotherhood. He's a man who trusts in a kind of love for the cosmos, love for the earth, love for history, love for the different people and their cultures. He's really a man of peace.
So what has angered the Algerian government so much about him?
Well, he's a writer of the size of the Solzhenitsyn. If you want to compare, it's there that you have to go, Solzhenitsyn. He says the truth about the official history. He puts it down. For a kind of regime like the one that, unfortunately, the Algerian people have today on their back, truth is unbearable.
Parce que, tout simplement, c'est qu'au lendemain de l'indépendance, c'est un pouvoir idéologique, c'est à la soviétique.
Sansal had been getting up the nose of the Algerian government for many years. From semi-exile in France, he wrote about corruption, about what he saw as the carve-up of power between the Algerian military and Islamists, about the threat to France of Islamists.
Le peuple va manifester tout le temps et qui n'obéit pas aux directives.
And in this interview, on a website close to France's hard-right National Rally Party, not long before his arrest, he may have overstepped the mark, calling into question aspects of Algeria's official account of its own history.
Moi personnellement, ce Boualem Sansal, moi c'est.
On the internet, the reaction from pro-Algerian influencers in France has been vitriolic, accusing Sansal of being a stooge for Marine Le Pen. The president of Algeria, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, gave an interview saying that the whole affair was a concoction intended to mobilize opinion against Algeria. The truth is that Boualem Sansal is caught up in a bigger crisis, which is the recent breakdown in relations between France and Algeria, possibly the worst since Algerian independence 60 years ago. Sansal is a victim and a kind of hostage. He's never written a word that is seditious or inflammatory, merely described the world around him as he sees it. His lawyer, still waiting for the chance to visit him in prison, is François Zimeret.
He's a free thinker, and as all free thinkers and free minds, his thoughts and beliefs might have shocked or irritated This is incumbent to freedom of speech, in fact, but at the end of the day, I still don't see how his words could have endangered a state of 45 million inhabitants.
That's Francois Zimmeray talking to Hugh Schofield in Paris. Just time before we leave you for a reminder of our main headline. Hamas says it has handed over another body to the Red Cross in Gaza. It says this time it is that of the Israeli hostage Shiri Bibas. There was anger in Israel when remains sent back in a coffin yesterday turned out not to be hers. The Israeli military says it's investigating. Well, I'm off on my travels now. Jamie, though, will be here in the chair on Monday. I'll be back with you in a few weeks' time. For now, that's the world tonight. Good night. And have a good weekend.
Hey, Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business Small Business Success Stories, produced by Ruby Studio and Intuit QuickBooks. Catch up on seasons 1 and 2 and join us for a brand new season of the podcast as we talk to small business owners about how they manage and grow their businesses with the help of platforms like Intuit QuickBooks.
Listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.